And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and on season two, I'm joined by legendary rock star Patty Quatro, where we take a deep dive into her Detroit roots, the indelible impact of her iconic musical family, her two pioneering all-female bands, The Pleasure Seekers and Cradle, hanging with her homeboys in Detroit Rock City, and so much more. So let's get started.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Song, let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true.
Patty, I'm so excited to speak to you about your brother, Michael Quatro. And I want to take a deep dive into your brother's incredible talents, his legacies. There's so much to get to because in season one, it wasn't just your dad's huge musical influence on you and your sisters. It was, and then your epiphany with the Beatles. That was huge, saying, I want to do that. And not crying like the girls around you, your girlfriends. But I think Michael Quatro, or as you call him, Mickey, or as his friends call him, Mike, but let's just for this context, call him Mickey. I think your brother Mickey is maybe equally as influential on you as your dad, dare I say. And yes. I would like you to really bring us back in time with, tell us about your brother. I mean, you've been quoted as saying he was the most talented of all of you, God-given talent. You also say about him, just all of you would say to him, just put a tape over your mouth and just play, which I think is a hilarious image. But just first of all, what did you mean by that? Give us a little insight into your brother's personality, and then we're going to go back in time.
Oh, my God. Well, we did call him Madness in Motion. He lived on the edge of genius crazy, very high intellect. And he was a comedian. Oh, my God. Can you imagine growing up with four sisters and finding your place in that environment? I mean, you know, you all grow up with sibling shit going on all the time. And there he was with these four sisters. And we all had the lessons and all that. And he was taking piano. And I mean, Dad noticed, you know, his talent right away. He was, as I said, kissed by God. He was the purest talent in the family. And I'll get into that. You know, yes, one of the famous managers that handled him, Lieber and Krebs, they do Aerosmith, right? I mean, later, I'm just hopping for a minute. They didn't want to go on stage after him. That's how good he was. And Lieber and Krebs just wanted to put him in white tails, sit him on stage, put a tape on his mouth, and just play because he had a mouth on him. And we always said the same thing, just play. That's your language, because he could be abrasive and blunt and just, you know, his mind was always going a million miles a minute of things he wanted to do and ideas he had. But to backtrack, he was bullied as a kid when he was.
I want to hear. Okay, that I want to hear. Hold that bully thought, because that's really important, and that I did not know. But for the listeners who may not have the chronology yet of your entire family down, like you do or I do, so it's Arlene is the firstborn.
Yes.
Mickey is secondborn. And then it's you, Susie, and Nancy.
Right. So
he is absolutely in the thick of being around all of these girls. So I just wanted to remind the listeners of that. So go back to what you were saying about him being bullied.
Okay. Because it tells a little bit about his personality. He was bullied. Arlene used to tell us the kids, he had his music satchel coming home from school to go to his lessons, and they would make fun of him and all that stuff. So he had to sort of grow up with a tough hide to, you know, do that. He was the odd one that was taking piano lessons and all that. And he had this large basement, okay? And he would go downstairs, had a big pool table in it. He was a pool hustler. He almost got beat up a few times. He was such a hustler. He did trick shots and everything. He has all these talents. And he would make a hockey game in the basement with goalies, right? And he would make a tape that would have the cheering and the booing. And he would play with us sisters. And if we got a goal, it would be, you know, boo, boo. And if he got one, it would, yeah. I mean, he did all this shit. He used to make records.
Wait, I have to interrupt because first of all, that is such a fabulous just vision to think of that with the boo and the yay. But also it reminds me of your father playing the organ for the games of, you know, funny songs.
Same thing. He probably picked it up from him. He just wanted to do all this creative stuff early on to widen that lens. He just had those talents. I remember he used to make Martian records where he would make these, I don't know how to describe it, Martian talking stuff, and then he'd weave in a story. I mean, he would record all this into a little product on his tape machine. Just so creative. And then there was the comedian side. We would be on the pot in the bathroom, and we had a door in the hallway that put towels away. He would stick his head in and say, "Hey, what you doing?" I mean, you know, because it could come through into the bathroom. Or we'd be coming down in the hallway. We had this long hallway. And he would be around the corner with a wash rag, soaking wet, right? Here we come, just doing our life. And he would throw it right at our face, splat, dripping everywhere. He'd sell makeup. And then he'd run. You know, he was so pesky. So pesky. And I remember one time we got him back. He was in his duded up sequin jacket, ready to do one of his gigs, right, with Dad. We shoved him into the bathroom, cans of whipped cream all over the jacket, shoved him into the shower. And this was no cheap sequin jacket. So we got him back big time.
I love that. Now, I'm an only child, so I don't know anything about antics of siblings. But with him sneaking in on you girls in the bathroom, I mean, that just takes little shit to a whole new level, doesn't it?
Oh, my God. He was crazy, crazy, crazy.
So I want to pull back, though, a little bit, because you were saying he was bullied because he was carrying home a satchel of music. So how old was he during this time? And you said your father started to see his talents. Talk a little bit more about that.
He saw him. He was playing already with Dad on some gigs. You know, he was taking piano and all that, just little stuff here and there. He was probably in elementary school, you know, maybe the older fifth, sixth grade. I mean, he started early with the piano. And then Dad saw his talent and he thought, I got to get him a proper teacher, you know, enough of this young teacher, piano teacher stuff, because we were all taking vocal lessons with our choir teacher from school, Mr. Towsley. He would come and teach all of us. And Mickey was taking piano, and we were all taking piano, and we all had music in school, you know, different bands and stuff that we were in. But Mickey was the one that Dad noticed with his talent. And so there had been this lady that had heard him too, and she recommended this Misha Kotler guy, who was the Russian symphony player. And Dad decided, I wonder if I can get an audition with him for Mickey. So he took him, and the guy, oh my God, talk about, you know, the rulers on the hands, and no, that's incorrect. And I mean, that's what kind of teacher he was. He was with the Detroit Symphony. And he listened to Mickey play. And this was probably, he was probably around 13, maybe 12, 13, still young. And he said, I have never seen fingers as strong as he has. Even his pinky is as strong as the rest of his fingers. He said, he's not that great, but I think I can do something with him. He was a real hard ass, you know. He wasn't going to give any quarter to, you know, telling Dad, oh, your kid is talented. That's just the way it was. He knew he had to train him and make something of him. So he said, I think I can do something with him. So he was going to take him. And then the home practices, he was taking. We would test him at home. We would turn him around as he got to be like 13, 14. We would turn him around and play a discord on the piano. I mean, a mash of notes. If you know what a discord is, you know, it's like nothing harmonious. It's just, you know, and he would turn around and tell us every note that we had played. He had the most perfect pitch I've ever seen. And we all have it, but he had it in spades. So, you know, and he's developing. He was playing with the events and stuff, like with the symphony. And he would have a comic book next to the music because he already knew the music. He was so irreverent. I mean, this is the kind of shit he did. He would in between, he'd be looking at his comic. He had a collection of Walt Disney comic books. He was rabid over his comic book collection. So there it was on the piano with the symphony.
Again, another great visual. I absolutely love that. I want to, again, I have more questions. So was piano the only instrument he was drawn to? Was that like his one thing? And was he also a vocalist? Was he joining in on doing harmonies with you? Tell us a little bit about his music development. It was purely piano?
Purely piano. That was his gift. It was obvious to everybody. Whenever he would play gigs, he would be made over, and the people, you know, I mean, that's how the Welk thing happened, which we'll get to, because a society lady, she saw him and freaked out. She said, you know, there's a big audition happening in Los Angeles for the Lawrence Welk show.
Now, wait, who was this society lady and where did she see him? How did this come about?
I think her name was Mrs. Slocum, and she really loved his talent and was just enamored of Mickey when he would play a gig with my dad, you know, because he was still doing gigs. He was still taking piano with Misha Kotler, and he was still doing gigs and different things. And she would see him because Dad played all the society clubs with the da-di-da music. Okay. Yeah. So there was Mickey playing with him and Susie sometimes on bongos, you know, I mean, it was a family business. So anyway, she saw him and she told Dad about this audition. And I think she's the one that wrote Lawrence Welk, and because they were doing a nationwide search.
Now, I this is going to date you and I, but for those who may not know, could you tell us who Lawrence Welk was at the time and what he meant to people at the time?
Yes. Yes. It was a huge, really popular musical show, all music, and they had sponsors, the big car companies, et cetera, another tie into Detroit and the world and, you know, all the interest in cars. And his was the one that was the standard, Okay. And it was all da-di-da music. I right up Dad's alley, you know, all the standard hits of the 50s and 60s, you know, all that kind of music. And he had what he called a big band, and he was going to start what he called a little band of young kids that were talented. So he wanted to audition and find the right people. And he had the fabulous Lennon sisters. Oh my God. Pure as the driven snow. They sang in four-part harmony and they did all the songs. And his show ran for, oh, quite a few years. I mean, if you Googled it, you'd see so many. There's archives. Just
I'm born late 1967 and I watched it as a kid and those were not reruns. So it ran a long time and it was as straight-laced as any TV show there was.
Oh, yeah. And he was a hoot. He would go like, oh, God, Lawrence Welk, a one and a two. And he'd have this whole way of starting off the band every time. And then they would camera to the audience doing some dancing. My mother got to be in the audience once with Dad, you know, when they went to the audition. It was hilarious. But, you know, we were glued. We watched it. It was the music show. That was it. There was nothing else. Elvis hadn't hit yet. None of that was going on yet. So that's how young it was. 1950, they must have started around 56, 55, something like that. Mickey was on in 58 for 2 years. So, and then it kept going. I mean, season after season. So it was quite a big deal.
Well, I want to hear more about the audition and how that all came about. But I did want to, as you said, tying it all in back to Detroit and the car industry. I do think it's interesting, as you and I like to say a lot, you know, widening the historic lens, because all of this contributes to your musical family, that mm-hmm. you had your grandfather who came to Detroit to try and break into a nascent car industry. Then you mm-hmm. had your father who was in the car industry and it was booming, but it wasn't enough to support his larger family and the status that he wanted. So music became secondary, but almost in the forefront, if you will. And then there's your brother, Mike, who now, along with the generation that we've been talking about, your homeboys, and we'll get to more of that later, but he's coming up in that group of saying, absolutely not. I'm not going into that car industry. That is like a death trap for me in the sense of my life. And isn't it interesting that he gets an audition with the Lawrence Welk show that's sponsored by the car manufacturers in Detroit. So I can't wait to hear more about this.
Well, you know, it's really interesting because Mickey, his ego, he wasn't even involved in, you know, oh, I don't want to go in the car industry. I don't think he even thought about that. You know, everybody else in Detroit did, but he was so into what he was doing and building this life with Dad and the music. I think that captured him a bit, you know, and it became his way of making his stand in the world because he knew he had confidence. He knew he was talented. You know, I mean, God, he got told all the time.
Good night. Good night, until we meet.